at the Vancouver Institute about a month ago, I pointed out that, of course, the Institute has considerable expenses and that we would appreciate memberships and donations, especially from those of you who attend regularly. Well, at the end of that that evening, a rather kindly elderly gentleman came up and said that he was terribly sorry that this was his last session at the Vancouver Institute, that he simply couldn't afford a membership fee. So I, of course, said, well, we're far more anxious to have you at the Institute than to have your membership. By all means, come. I hope he's here tonight. And I would say the same to you all. What we want is above all, is your attendance. Your membership, your donation is a secondary matter. On the other hand... if it is not a burden to you, membership in the Vancouver Institute would be very much appreciated. We do have expenses, considerable expenses. It is no easy matter, it is no cheap matter to put together week after week a program of Institute quality. And we have absolutely no intention down the line of relinquishing the standard of the Vancouver Institute. So if you can join, please do join. If you can offer a donation to the Vancouver Institute, please do so. Well, enough said on that score. It is, of course, towards the end of 1984, the year that George Orwell made us all somewhat apprehensive about. And I trust you appreciate the nicety of Institute planning. George Orwell was a major figure in English letters. Major because of the quality of his writing, his absolutely clear, lucid prose, his wonderful prose, and too, the acuity of his political and his social thought. I suspect a good many of you in this room have favorite passages from the man. I do, and as I have the floor for a short while, I'm going to read one. This is from Orwell's essay, The Lion and the Unicorn, in which he's offering some general comments about the shape of English culture. Wonderful comments, I think. By far the best essay that I know on this topic. And towards the end, he says that, apropos generally of English society, that more than anything else, it resembles a family, a rather stuffy Victorian family, with not many black sheep in it, but with all its cupboards bursting with skeletons. It has rich relations who have to be kowtowed to, and poor relations who are horribly sat upon. And there is a deep conspiracy of silence about the family income. It is a family in which the young are generally thwarted, and most of the power is in the hands of irresponsible uncles and bedridden aunts. Still, it is a family. Well, that's George Orwell. The other side of Institute planning, the double edge, if you will, of Institute planning, is that we have with us tonight another distinguished English figure of letters and political thought. Dr. Bernard Crick is a professor of politics at Birkbeck College, an affiliate of the University of London. He tells me he's just retired, that he's taken an early retirement, and that he's heading to Scotland there to write. Well, he's already written a great deal. There are some dozen books to his name, most of them dealing with political theory, some with politics, most of them on the British Isles, but some ranging more widely. There's a book on American politics. There's a book on China in transition. And there's a book with the rather promising title, Crime, Rape, and Gin, Reflections on Contemporary Attitudes Towards Violence, Pornography, and Addiction. Professor Crick has won many awards. He's been invited to a great many conferences. But all of that, in a way, is rather beside the point. The main fact about Professor Crichton Knight is that he has written an absolutely splendid biography of George Orwell. To the extent that there can be a definitive biography of anyone, this is a definitive biography. It begins with Orwell's early life. It follows him through a prep school, which he absolutely detested, and which left him with some of the images of tyranny that appear in his later life. It goes on through Orwell at Eton, where his passage was relatively undistinguished, and it follows his life of letters and of thought. It ends with these few sentences. In striving to keep a deliberate balance between public and private values, between creative work and necessary labor, between politics and culture, Orwell's life and writings should both guide and cheer us. He hated the power-hungry, exercised intelligence and independence, and taught us again to use our language with beauty and clarity, sought for and practiced fraternity, and had faith in the decency, tolerance, and humanity of the common man. And what is even more heartening, he was all that, and yet as odd in himself and as varied in his friends as a man can be. Well, that's good writing. That's really good writing. That's just as good writing as George Orwell could achieve. And Orwell was one of the masters of our language. Sir, we're absolutely delighted that you're here tonight. It's my pleasure and honor to invite you to speak on the other Orwell, Getting Beyond 1984, Dr. Bernard Crick.
Professor Hunt, ladies and gentlemen, I'm deeply grateful for that introduction and slightly embarrassed that you've read there are two purple passages in the biography in which I stepped out of the rather boring and dull business of trying to give an account of somebody's life without pretending that one can ever get inside anybody else's mind, which I think once one gets beyond the age of about 17, one grows to realize is fallacious, and that even people very close to one doesn't really know what they are really thinking. One can only observe their behavior. So most of the book, I do assure you, is reasonably scholarly, but I just had a little, having kept myself under very good restraint most of the time, I just had a little socialist rant at the end. By the way, can you hear me at the back? Good, so this thing is working. There's a story of the late Lord Rosebery, who was speaking on the floor of the House of Lords, and somebody shouted, "Speak up," and he affably replied, "I would if I thought that anyone were listening." Well, and I do like to make sure of that at the beginning. This awful year will soon be over. And I think we'll get into 1985, and perhaps during the very end of this year, or perhaps next year, we may get Orwell in a little proportion. Stocks in 1985 are going extremely well, but luckily there's a bit of buoyancy in the rest of the Orwell market. I put it to you that there are two images in the very way in which we talk about the man. One can say Orwellian, or one can say Orwell-like. And when one says Orwellian, I suppose one means a doom-laden prophet of disaster, or at least a pretty gloomy cove, or certainly a super-saturated seriousness. When one says Orwell-like, I think one probably means the lover of language, the eccentric, the pastoralist, the better one knows the writings, probably the comic touch, the whimsical touch. And both these I think, are a part of the man. And he used the image before others used it of him. George Woodcock used the image of Orwell as Don Quixote, but as very often with these attributions of a dominant image to somebody, Orwell had in fact used that of himself. And he used it of himself in one of his typical essays that I almost blush to mention in this serious year of 1984, an essay called The Art of Donald McGill. Well, who was Donald McGill? He was actually the original man who drew all those seaside postcards with the big bottoms and the rude captions underneath them that even penetrated from my native land to North America, or the kind of postcards, I forget whether Orwell gives this particular example, but you know the kind of postcards, judge to the defendant, did you sleep with this woman? No, my lord, not a wink. And Orwell, rather surprisingly, it wasn't the kind of thing that literary critics did, but still, was he even trying to be a literary critic? He devotes a serious article to what is the significance of this form of popular art. And he asks, if you look into your own mind, which are you, Don Quixote or Sancho Panza? Almost certainly you're both. There's one part of you that wishes to be a hero or a saint, but another part of you is a little fat man who sees very clearly the advantages of staying alive with a whole skin. He is your unofficial self, the voice of the belly protesting against the soul. His tastes lie towards safety, soft beds, no work, pots of beer, and women with voluptuous figures. He it is who punches your fine attitudes and urges you to look after number one, to be unfaithful to your wife, to bilk your debts, and so on and so forth. Whether you allow yourself to be influenced by him is a different question, but it is simply a lie to say that he's not part of you, just as it is a lie to say that Don Quixote is not part of you either, though much of what is said and written consists of one lie or the other, usually the first. And a paragraph later, he reverts to the nominal subject matter of the essay. A dirty joke is not, of course, a serious attack upon morality, but it is a sort of mental rebellion, a momentary wish that things were otherwise. So also with all other jokes, which always center around cowardice, laziness, dishonesty, or some other quality which society cannot afford to encourage. Society has always to demand a little more from human beings than it will get in practice. It has to demand faultless discipline and self-sacrifice. It must expect its subjects to work hard, pay their taxes, be faithful to their wives. It must assume that men think it glorious to die on the battlefield and women want to wear themselves out with childbearing. The whole of what one may call official literature is founded on such assumptions. I never read the proclamations of generals before battle, the speeches of Führers and prime ministers, the solidarity songs of public schools and left-wing political parties, very naughty coupling, national anthems, temperance tracts, papal encyclicals, and sermons against gambling and contraception, without seeming to hear in the background a chorus of raspberries from all the millions of common men to whom these high sentiments make no appeal. Nevertheless, the high sentiments always win in the end. The leaders who offer blood, toil, and tears and sweat always get more out of their followers than those who offer safety and a good time. When it comes to the pinch, human beings are heroic. Women face childbed and the scrubbing brush. Revolutionaries keep their mouths shut in the torture chamber. Battleships go down with their guns still firing when their decks are awash. It's only that the other element in man, the lazy, cowardly, debt-bilking adulterer who is inside all of us, can never be suppressed altogether and needs a hearing occasionally. If people were already aware, or whatever you think of that strange passage, of that kind of passage, and one could match it with many more in Orwell, I could just read Orwell all night, really, and except for fear you might want your money back, but that might be the best way of representing the other Orwell. If people can read 1984 and Animal Farm without knowing passages like that, it seems to me overwhelmingly likely, as is the case, that they may form a slightly more gloomy view of those two books than perhaps the a strict reading of the text would allow. One of the difficulties with satire is that if you are really pulling off a good satiric joke, you don't put your heart on your sleeve. You conceal your own nominal position. The satire is the inverse, or the converse, rather, of what you actually mean. And that if some humorless people, or perhaps some very ignorant people, or perhaps some people the other side of the globe who are reading you in a foreign translation have no idea of what your actual position is, it could possibly just be taken, I imagine, that 1984 is a statement of utter despair, and indeed it could even be taken as a prophecy that the end of the world is going to take place in 1984. I think before getting back to the other Orwell, oh dear, it is necessary to say something about 1984. There used to be, indeed, advertisements in English newspapers asking the bishops to open the boxes of the witch or the prophet, or of the Tudor witch or prophetess Joanna Southcott. And so they should be. I'm all for open government. And some people seem, however, to see George Orwell's 1984 very much in that light, as if the end of the world is being prophesied. But then others try to distance it entirely by pointing out that none of his prophecies have come true, and that the political institutions of this year, 1984, are nothing like those of Oceania and the world of Big Brother, or perhaps we better carefully now say Big Person, so that it can fit both of them. Both sets of people, those who take it literally and those who dismiss it because it hasn't come true, a lot of the popular press in those ghastly first 2 weeks of January were taking that very silly line, you know, what was 1984 saying, and do you think these prophecies have come to pass? And I would say, well, have you ever heard of anything being a satire? Do you know what satire means? But still, I didn't get very far that way in a one-minute interview on Italian television or something. But both, in their different ways, are being far too literal-minded and are evading the real issue. Orwell's satire was about the recognisable world of 1948, but the depressing thing, is, to my mind, is that nearly all of his caps still fit our saddened heads. There's not much mystery about Orwell's politics. I brush aside the activities of many tomb robbers and body snatchers and sort of progressive and sort of astrological necrophiliacs who are absolutely sure what Orwell would say today and where he would stand today if he was alive. I'm only sure that he would be 80 years old and would be lucky to, with respect to some in the audience, would be lucky to have his marbles about him. If one locates him in his last known address, in 1950 he was a fairly conventional English left-wing Tribune socialist, whatever that means. Well, that means he wasn't a Marxist, he hadn't got much theoretical baggage, but a fierce libertarian as well as being a fierce egalitarian, very much in the same political position as the man he knew then. They both worked together at Tribune at roughly speaking the same time, Michael Foot or an Aaron Bevan. But few socialist thinkers before Orwell had become almost obsessed with the realization that progress was not automatic, and that at the end of the Second World War, for the first time in two centuries of human history, it was reasonable to fear that the future would not be better than the past. I'm notoriously impatient with psychological explanations of 1984, and one reason is because it seems to me perfectly reasonable to be terribly pessimistic at the end of the First World War, particularly after the Hiroshima bomb had been exploded, and that anybody who looked forward thinking that the post-World War would be glorious and that all had been settled by the war wanted their head tested or was living in a fool's paradise. It seems to me that Orwell's pessimism, there are degrees of pessimism, but Orwell's pessimism must be thought to be, at least at first blush, fairly reasonable. It was quite reasonable to fear that the future would not be better than the past. He was warning people against false optimism, against thinking that the end of the war might have solved all problems, and particularly warning through the novel and his essays of that period that there stalked the presence of the new atom bomb and its consequences for the world. In an essay written early in 1947, that's about the time when he's beginning to write, to compose 1984, an essay called Towards European Unity, he wrote of the grim possibility that the fear inspired by the atomic bomb and other weapons yet to come will be so great that everybody will refrain from using them. This seems to me the worst possibility of all. Oh, but of course he was talking about the atom bomb Mark I. He wasn't talking about the hydrogen bomb. Nobody thought it could pollute the whole atmosphere or create a deep and everlasting winter. This seems to me the worst possibility of all. It would mean the division of the world between two or three vast superstates, unable to conquer one another and unable to be overthrown by an internal rebellion. In all probability, their structure would be hierarchic, with a semi-divine caste at the top and outright slavery at the bottom. And the crushing out of liberty would exceed anything the world has yet seen. Within each world, the necessary psychological atmosphere would be kept up by complete severance from the outside world and by a continuous phony war against rival states. Civilizations of this kind might remain static for thousands of years. So in calling 1984 a satire, I'm not saying that some of the essential elements of the plot were not meant by him very literally. Indeed, the first and obvious subject of satire in the novel, so obvious that many literary critics seem to ignore it as being so obvious as not to be worth mentioning, is this slight matter of the division of the world between the great powers. And this division of the world, in Orwell's mind, had already taken place at Yalta and Potsdam. It's the pigs and the men carving up the farmyard between them at the end of Animal Farm. He'd already had a go at that one. And to my mind, the calling of Britain as Airstrip 1, calling Great Britain Airstrip 1 in Orwell's imaginary Oceania in 1984, that was a very old joke indeed. It's been Airstrip 1. We've had the honour to be Airstrip 1 in my country since 1941, when the airstrips were being prepared for the Boeing bombers to bomb Germany that hadn't even been produced as yet in the Lockheed factories. Very nice piece of wartime planning. That's a very old joke, so please don't laugh too loud in case the house falls down. That one was a fairly easy prophecy. That's not about the future, it's about, well, the continuous present. And when Winston Smith reads Goldstein's Testament, the revolutionary book of the Brotherhood, allegedly, he learns that after a short atomic war in 1956, the great powers have realized that they will wipe each other out if they use them, so therefore they only stockpile them. Why do they stockpile useless bombs? Goldstein explains that the burning off of surplus value by military expenditure is so that the existing elites can be preserved by preventing the abolition of poverty that would give equality and therefore political power to the masses. It's a rather crude, some of you may think, socialist satire. Now, we British on Airstrip 1 certainly do not live in a military dictatorship of the kind that even the non-fictional Orwell feared, and nor do North American inhabitants of Oceania either. But we do surely live in a society with a crazily unnecessary possession of atomic weapons, a vast military expenditure, and now a huge apparatus of security surveillance. Swift, Orwell's hero and model, did not, in his Gulliver's Travels, believe that there were giants in Brobdingnag, and nor did most of his readers, but he did believe that mankind could be brutal and reckless towards each other, not merely conscious brutality, but the brutality that sometimes happens in everyday life as well as in politics when one treads on somebody because one doesn't notice that they're there. And Swift did not believe that there were dwarves in a place called Lilliput either, but he did believe, wicked man, wicked satirist, that men could be pompous, parochial, and petty-minded. Similarly with Orwell, his second great satiric thrust in the book is simply the abuse of power in general. Oh yes, totalitarian power, Soviet power, but also a fear that something like Nazi power might recur. He's writing in 1948, he's not writing in 1984, and also, I think, protesting against quite ordinary abuses of power in everyday life, when people tread on other people or, as I said, don't even notice that they're there. When the interrogator, torturer O'Brien, in the interrogation scene, gives Winston Smith, like in any good quiz program, a free question, and Winston asks what they are doing it all for, he bleakly replies that they are doing it for nothing, simply for the sake of power. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. Now, I don't believe for one moment that Orwell thought that all men were like that, but he is suggesting that many men are like that and that power can corrupt. Indeed, Orwell, in his non-fictional essays, specifically denied that totalitarian regimes didn't believe in their ideologies. He said in an essay on Hitler, "Don't fool yourself that Hitler is just a power-hungry clown. Better to see Hitler as Antichrist. He really does believe in the ideology." And yet in 1984, Orwell pictures the inner party as believing in nothing. So to that extent, he isn't directly satirizing either Nazism or communism at that point. He is satirizing any possible abuse of power, those who do become power hungry, not merely in national political situations, but as I say, in everyday life. He had a liberal feeling, close to Lord Acton's famous dictum, that all power corrupts, against which we have to guard ourselves rationally, and that indeed absolute power corrupts absolutely. He's not merely getting at Stalin and Hitler or possible future Stalins and Hitlers, He's getting at the pompous dog. He's getting at the pompous boss and the petty dog in office. The nominal target of the storyline is a future totalitarianism one. Is a future totalitarianism. The actual one is ever-present bureaucracy and any jack in office or public servant who grows too big for his boots and forgets whom he serves. He was one of the first to speculate that the real enemy of the future might not be a bad ideology, but a mundane bureaucracy. Another related object of Orwell's satire, to whom he had an almost perverse suspicion, were the intellectuals. He felt that by and large the intellectuals had betrayed the common people, had ceased to stand for the old radical image of organize and agitate, had settled down into quiet, comfortable jobs in schools, universities, the BBC, or publishing. Winston and his companions in the Ministry of Truth in the novel, the poet Ampleforth, the dictionary maker Syme, Winston himself perpetually rewriting the Times, God, what a job, and falsifying history, are all parodies of intellectuals who should know better, who do know better, but who decide to stick to their jobs rather than protest. And we all know, after all, in the universities and elsewhere, that if we do resign on a point of principle, some even bigger bastard will be appointed in our place. So we soldier on. I think, actually, Orwell's wartime service in the BBC had a very, very bad effect on him indeed. He'd never seen so many intellectuals all gathered together in one place, all broadcasting in strange languages to different parts of the world, and I fear he had certain doubts about whether these men would stand up for their principles. A little bit self-righteous of him, perhaps. There has been so much in the popular press this year about 1984, but not a whisper that one of the great satiric targets in the novel is the popular press itself. Winston refers several times to rubbishy newspapers being produced in the Ministry of Truth to divert and debase the proles, in that marvellous word, to provide prole feed. Films, football, beer, and above all gambling filled up the horizons of their mind. To keep them in control was not difficult. And he describes the newspapers as being filled with this, with sex, with violence, with crime, with anything except serious politics. That's what Dear Julia is mainly working on, and her colleagues. Like many 19th century radicals had, Orwell had hoped that a century of the mass franchise and 50 years of compulsory secondary education would have created an active participant mass of citizens. In fact, he saw, in his gloomy vision, millions of people reading rubbishy newspapers soon to turn into telescreens. Winston Smith and Orwell believed that if there was hope, it lay in the proles. He perhaps romanticized, certainly idolized, the virtues and morality of the common man. He really did believe that the middle classes are more racked by competitive individualism, are more racked by desire for material goods, and are pushed in a position of a competitive individualism, and he really did believe that the working men or the common people had more fraternity and solidarity. But nonetheless, he felt a bitter, Swiftian rage at the actual content of the mass press of his day. Remember what dear Julia's job consisted in? Writing pornographic novels for the proles by machinery. Again, listen to what Orwell has to say in a contemporary essay of 1946 called The Prevention of Literature. And he's so humorless that he even has a go at the great democratic god of childhood of that time, the saintly Walt Disney. It would probably be not beyond human ingenuity to write books by machinery. But a sort of mechanizing process can already be seen at work in the film and radio, in publicity and propaganda, and in the lower reaches of journalism. Disney films, for instance, are produced by what is essentially a factory process, the work being done partly mechanically and partly by means of artists who have to subordinate their individual style. Radio features are commonly written by tired hacks to whom the subject and manner of treatment are dictated beforehand. Even so, what they write is merely a kind of raw material to be chopped into shape by producers and censors, and he ends with a magnificently gratuitous generalization. So also with the innumerable books and pamphlets commissioned by government departments. Now that business about the kind of raw material to be chopped into shape by producers and censors is actually a metaphor without any very clear technical subject matter. He was writing before the common use of radio tape. No wonder the courts are so very, very cautious, in my country at least, about using evidence based on tape recorders, when it's so easy to stitch together and make anything you want of it. There is rumoured to be, in the depths of the Ministry of Truth, I mean in the BBC, an obscene Christmas address by Her Majesty the Queen. done as a kind of technical exercise in a BBC training school, but I think also, you know, as a kind of warning shot to demonstrate outside the building, don't trust tapes. All this, that kind of passage I've read, is the generation, the origin of the idea of prole feed in 1984. The main instrument of controlling the masses has become, according to Orwell, not coercion and surveillance, but cultural debasement. As a fellow called Gramsci in an Italian prison, or had been in an Italian prison, had been arguing, quite unknown to Orwell. That's what the highbrow Marxists mean by cultural hegemony. It is too little noticed that the author tells us specifically in 1984 that the thought police go very rarely into the streets and homes of the proles, that there are very few telescreens in the homes of the proles. It's badly wrong there. It is the bureaucracy in the novel, or the outer party, who are subject to the maximum of terror and surveillance. The proles are kept controlled most economically by cultural debasement and by the provision by the state of pornography, gambling, booze and drugs. Our kind of state, Orwell knew quite well, does not provide those kind of things, it only tolerates them. It does not itself actually provide them. He did exaggerate. It was a literary satire, like Swift's Gulliver. It is full of deliberately grotesque exaggerations. These things are there just as strongly as the more obvious, as the more often noticed satires on the debasement of language and on the perversion of historical truth. But Orwell, in fact, is not despairing. He does not believe that newspeak will ever work, that it is possible to control language utterly, nor that history could ever be completely rewritten. I think he simply fears the cruelty and suffering that follow from political attempts to do so. A press release issued after the appearance of the book, which I reprint both in my biography and in my recent Clarendon Press edition of 1984. A press release says that it was his view that this or something like... Sorry, The press release denies that it was his view that this or something like this is what will happen within the next 40 years in the Western world. He said that, allowing for the book being, after all, a parody, something like 1984 could happen. Not will happen, but could happen. This is the direction in which the world is going in at the present time, and the trend lies deep in the political and social and economic foundations of the contemporary world situation. Indeed, he went further. Specifically, the danger lies in the structure imposed on capitalist, socialist, and liberal communities alike. Now, he plainly, by capitalist, socialist, and liberal, I'm afraid he means North America, Europe, which he rather optimistically thought was going democratic socialist after the war, and liberal communities, by the necessity to prepare for war with the USSR and the new weapons, of which, of course, the atom bomb is the most powerful and the most publicized. He did not despair, but was he wrong to find it hard to provide false optimism rather than warnings of the bleak and cruel world into which we may descend, even now, if we lose our respect for truth, liberty, and human equality? Above all else, in 1984, Orwell is satirizing the pretensions of a rigidly hierarchical society, the sole raison d'etre of the political regime in Oceania is to prevent equality. Now, I certainly concede, as would Orwell, above all, that an egalitarian regime without liberty can be, indeed would be, totalitarian and enforced equality. But the much greater likelihood, he thought, in the modern world is that hierarchical regimes based upon the seeming need to accumulate huge defense expenditures, create not a literal 1984, but something bad enough to make us feel, when reading the novel again, that too little has improved, that some things have even got worse, and that there is much to be done if they are not to get far, far worse. Orwell's democratic socialism, like R.H. Tawney's, was of that kind that distrusted the centralized state, whether nominally socialist or nominally capitalist. He liked small nations, provinces, localities. Above all, he disliked empires and superpowers. In an attack on a once fashionable intellectual, James Burnham, the author of The Managerial Revolution, Orwell wrote, "Centralized ownership has very little meaning unless the mass of people are living roughly upon an equal level and have some kind of control over government. The state may come to mean no more than a self-elected political party, and oligarchy and privilege can return based on power rather than on money." Socialists and radicals, Orwell would have us believe, must be as opposed to bureaucracy as they profess to be to class privilege. But no literary satire can be read like an economic or social model or projection. But the targets of his satire, if of varying and different significance, still seem to me things that should worry us, just as his respect for truth, liberty, and plain language should cheer us. We normally tackle the great problem of how to limit arbitrary power in two ways. One is to set power against power, or institutional restraints, the Constitution and all that. Two, we believe in reason, persuasion, debate, dialogue, some might add prayer. Orwell adds a third dimension, though, that is very often ignored, indeed is most often ignored by all the serious academic commentators about how to limit arbitrary power, but is in fact the common or garden technique that most people who live under ordinary, under arbitrary power practice all day long and habitually, indeed even in free countries when we feel we have governments in for a very long run who are unlikely to be changed, there's usually a great outbreak of satire. We use sardonic mockery to try to cut the pretensions of the great down to human size. I put it to you, to mention 1984 almost for the last time, that Orwell, both in Animal Farm and 1984, is offering a deliberate, controlled exercise in political satire. We should not read the whole thing too gloomily. Let me read the gloomiest passage of all, and
at the Vancouver Institute, about a month ago, I pointed out that, of course, the Institute has considerable expenses and that we would appreciate memberships and donations, especially from those of you who attend regularly. Well, at the end of that that evening, a rather kindly elderly gentleman came up and said that he was terribly sorry that this was his last session at the Vancouver Institute, that he simply couldn't afford a membership fee. So I, of course, said, well, we're far more anxious to have you at the Institute than to have your membership. By all means, come. I hope he's here tonight. And I would say the same to you all. What we want is above all, is your attendance. Your membership, your donation is a secondary matter. On the other hand, if it is not a burden to you, membership in the Vancouver Institute would be very much appreciated. We do have expenses, considerable expenses. It is no easy matter. It is no cheap matter to put together week after week a program of Institute quality. And we have absolutely no intention down the line of relinquishing the standard of the Vancouver Institute. So if you can join, please do join. If you can offer a donation to the Vancouver Institute, please do so. Well, enough said on that score. It is, of course, towards the end of 1984, the year that George Orwell made us all somewhat apprehensive about. And I trust you appreciate the nicety of Institute planning. George Orwell was a major figure in English letters. Major because of the quality of his writing, his absolutely clear, lucid prose, his wonderful prose, and too, the acuity of his political and his social thought. I suspect a good many of you in this room have favorite passages from the man. I do, and as I have the floor for a short while, I'm going to read one. This is from Orwell's essay, The Lion and the Unicorn, in which he's offering some general comments about the shape of English culture. Wonderful comments, I think. By far the best essay that I know on this topic. And towards the end, he says that, apropos generally of English society, that more than anything else, it resembles a family, a rather stuffy Victorian family, with not many black sheep in it, but with all its cupboards bursting with skeletons. It has rich relations who have to be kowtowed to, and poor relations who are horribly sat upon. And there is a deep conspiracy of silence about the family income. It is a family in which the young are generally thwarted, and most of the power is in the hands of irresponsible uncles and bedridden aunts. Still, it is a family. Well, that's George Orwell. The other side of Institute planning the double edge, if you will, of institute planning is that we have with us tonight another distinguished English figure of letters and political thought. Dr. Bernard Crick is a professor of politics at Birkbeck College, an affiliate of the University of London. He tells me he's just retired, that he's taken an early retirement, and that he's heading to Scotland there to write. Well, he's already written a great deal. There are some dozen books to his name, most of them dealing with political theory, some with politics, most of them on the British Isles, but some ranging more widely. There's a book on American politics. There's a book on China in transition. And there's a book with the rather promising title, Crime, Rape, and Gin, Reflections on Contemporary Attitudes Towards Violence, Pornography, and Addiction. Professor Crick has won many awards. He's been invited to a great many conferences. But all of that, in a way, is rather beside the point. The main fact about Professor Crick tonight is that he has written an absolutely splendid biography of George Orwell. To the extent that there can be a definitive biography of anyone, this is a definitive biography. It begins with Orwell's early life. It follows him through a prep school which he absolutely detested, and which left him with some of the images of tyranny that appear in his later life. It goes on through Orwell at Eton, where his passage was relatively undistinguished, and it follows his life of letters and of thought. It ends with these few sentences. In striving to keep a deliberate balance between public and private values, between creative work and necessary labor, between politics and culture, Orwell's life and writings should both guide and cheer us. He hated the power-hungry, exercised intelligence and independence, and taught us again to use our language with beauty and clarity, sought for and practiced fraternity, and had faith in the decency, tolerance, and humanity of the common man. And what is even more heartening, he was all that, and yet as odd in himself and as varied in his friends as a man can be. Well, that's good writing. That's really good writing. That's just as good writing as George Orwell could achieve. And Orwell was one of the masters of our language. Sir, we're absolutely delighted that you're here tonight. It's my pleasure and honor to invite you to speak on the other Orwell, Getting Beyond 1984, Dr. Bernard Crick.
Professor Hunt, ladies and gentlemen, I'm deeply grateful for that introduction and slightly embarrassed to have read there are two purple passages in the biography in which I stepped out of the rather boring and dull business of trying to give an account of somebody's life without pretending that one can ever get inside anybody else's mind, which I think once one gets beyond the age of about 17, one grows to realize is fallacious, and that even people very close to one doesn't really know what they're really thinking. One can only observe their behavior. So most of the book, I do assure you, is reasonably scholarly, but I just had a little, having kept myself under very good restraint most of the time, I just had a little socialist rant at the end. By the way, can you hear me at the back? Good, so this thing is working. There's a story of the late Lord Rosebery, who was speaking on the floor of the House of Lords, and somebody shouted, "Speak up," and he affably replied, "I would if I thought that anyone were listening." Well, and I do like to make sure of that at the beginning. This awful year will soon be over, and I think we'll get into 1985, and perhaps during the very end of this year, or perhaps next year, we may get Orwell in a little proportion. Stocks in 1985 are going extremely well, but luckily there's a bit of buoyancy in the rest of the Orwell market. I put it to you that there are two images in the very way in which we talk about the man. One can say Orwellian, or one can say Orwell-like. And when one says Orwellian, I suppose one means a doom-laden prophet of disaster, or at least a pretty gloomy cove, or certainly a super-saturated seriousness. When one says Orwell-like, I think one probably means the lover of language, the eccentric, the pastoralist, the better one knows the writings, probably the comic touch, the whimsical touch. And both these, I think, are a part of the man. And he used the image before others used it of him. George Woodcock used the image of Orwell as Don Quixote, but as very often with these attributions of a dominant image to somebody, Orwell had in fact used that of himself. And he used it of himself in one of his typical essays that I almost blush to mention in this serious year of 1984, an essay called The Art of Donald McGill. Well, who was Donald McGill? He was actually the original man who drew all those seaside postcards with the big bottoms and the rude captions underneath them that even penetrated from my native land to North America, or the kind of postcards, I forget whether Orwell gives this particular example, but you know the kind of postcards, judge to the defendant, did you sleep with this woman? No, my lord, not a wink. And Orwell, rather surprisingly, it wasn't the kind of thing that literary critics did, but still, was he even trying to be a literary critic? He devotes a serious article to what is the significance of this form of popular art. And he asks, if you look into your own mind, which are you, Don Quixote or Sancho Panza? Almost certainly you're both. There's one part of you that wishes to be a hero or a saint, but another part of you is a little fat man who sees very clearly the advantages of staying alive with a whole skin. He is your unofficial self, the voice of the belly protesting against the soul. His tastes lie towards safety, soft beds, no work, pots of beer, and women with voluptuous figures. He it is who punches your fine attitudes and urges you to look after number one, to be unfaithful to your wife, to bilk your debts, and so on and so forth. Whether you allow yourself to be influenced by him is a different question, but it is simply a lie to say that he's not part of you, just as it is a lie to say that Don Quixote is not part of you either, though much of what is said and written consists of one lie or the other, usually the first. And a paragraph later, he reverts to the nominal subject matter of the essay. A dirty joke is not, of course, a serious attack upon morality, but it is a sort of mental rebellion, a momentary wish that things were otherwise. So also with all other jokes, which always center around cowardice, laziness, dishonesty, or some other quality which society cannot afford to encourage. Society has always to demand a little more from human beings than it will get in practice. It has to demand faultless discipline and self-sacrifice. It must expect its subjects to work hard, pay their taxes, be faithful to their wives. It must assume that men think it glorious to die on the battlefield and women want to wear themselves out with childbearing. The whole of what one may call official literature is founded on such assumptions. I never read the proclamations of generals before battle, the speeches of Führers and prime ministers, the solidarity songs of public schools and left-wing political parties, a very naughty coupling, national anthems, temperance tracts, papal encyclicals, and sermons against gambling and contraception, without seeming to hear in the background a chorus of raspberries from all the millions of common men to whom these high sentiments make no appeal. Nevertheless, the high sentiments always win in the end. The leaders who offer blood, toil, and tears and sweat always get more out of their followers than those who offer safety and a good time. When it comes to the pinch, human beings are heroic. Women face childbed and the scrubbing brush. Revolutionaries keep their mouths shut in the torture chamber. Battleships go down with their guns still firing when their decks are awash. It's only that the other element in man, the lazy, cowardly, debt-bilking adulterer who is inside all of us, can never be suppressed altogether and needs a hearing occasionally. If people were already aware, or whatever you think of that strange passage, of that kind of passage, and one could match it with many more in Orwell, I could just read Orwell all night, really, except for fear you might want your money back, but that might be the best way of representing the other Orwell. If people can read 1984 and Animal Farm without knowing passages like that, it seems to me overwhelmingly likely, as is the case, that they may form a slightly more gloomy view of those two books than perhaps a strict reading of the text would allow. One of the difficulties with satire is that if you are really pulling off a good satiric joke, you don't put your heart on your sleeve. You conceal your own nominal position. The satire is the inverse, or the converse, rather, of what you actually mean. And that if some humorless people, or perhaps some very ignorant people, or perhaps some people the other side of the globe who are reading you in a foreign translation, have no idea of what your actual position is, it could possibly just be taken, I imagine, that 1984 is a statement of utter despair, and indeed it could even be taken as a prophecy that the end of the world is going to take place in 1984. I think before getting back to the other Orwell, oh dear, it is necessary to say something about 1984. There used to be, indeed, advertisements in English newspapers asking the bishops to open the boxes of the witch or the prophet, or of the Tudor witch or prophetess Joanna Southcott. And so they should be. I'm all for open government. And some people seem, however, to see George Orwell's 1984 very much in that light, as if the end of the world is being prophesied. But then others try to distance it entirely by pointing out that none of his prophecies have come true, and that the political institutions of this year, 1984, are nothing like those of Oceania and the world of Big Brother, or perhaps we better carefully now say Big Person, so that it can fit both of them. Both sets of people, those who take it literally and those who dismiss it because it hasn't come because it hasn't come true. A lot of the popular press in those ghastly first 2 weeks of January were taking that very silly line, you know, what was 1984 saying, and do you think these prophecies have come to pass? And I would say, well, have you ever heard of anything being a satire? Do you know what satire means? But still, I didn't get very far that way in a, you know, in a one-minute interview on Italian television or something. But both, in their different ways, are being far too literal-minded and are evading the real issue. Orwell's satire was about the recognisable world of 1948, but the depressing thing, is, to my mind, is that nearly all of his caps still fit our saddened heads. There's not much mystery about Orwell's politics. I brush aside the activities of many tomb robbers and body snatchers and sort of progressive and sort of astrological necrophiliacs who are absolutely sure what Orwell would say today and where he would stand today if he was alive. I'm only sure that he would be 80 years old and would be lucky to, with respect to some in the audience, would be lucky to have his marbles about him. If one locates him in his last known address, in 1950, he was a fairly conventional English left-wing Tribune socialist, whatever that means. Well, that means he wasn't a Marxist, he hadn't got much theoretical baggage, but a fierce libertarian as well as being a fierce egalitarian, very much in the same political position as the man he knew then. They both worked together at Tribune at roughly speaking the same time, Michael Foot or Aaron Bevan. But few socialist thinkers before Orwell had become almost obsessed with the realization that progress was not automatic, and that at the end of the Second World War, for the first time in two centuries of human history, it was reasonable to fear that the future would not be better than the past. I'm notoriously impatient with psychological explanations of 1984, and one reason is because it seems to me perfectly reasonable to be terribly pessimistic at the end of the First World War, particularly after the Hiroshima bomb had been exploded, and that anybody who looked forward thinking that the post-World War would be glorious and that all had been settled by the war wanted their head tested or was living in a fool's paradise. Seems to me that Orwell's pessimism, there are degrees of pessimism, but Orwell's pessimism must be thought to be, at least at first blush, fairly reasonable. It was quite reasonable to fear that the future would not be better than the past. He was warning people against false optimism, against thinking that the end of the war might have solved all problems, and particularly warning through the novel and his essays of that period that there stalked the presence of the new atom bomb and its consequences for the world. In an essay written early in 1947, that's about the time when he's beginning to write, to compose 1984, an essay called Towards European Unity, he wrote of the grim possibility that the fear inspired by the atomic bomb and other weapons yet to come will be so great that everybody will refrain from using them. This seems to me the worst possibility of all. Oh, but of course he was talking about the atom bomb Mark I. He wasn't talking about the hydrogen bomb. Nobody thought it could pollute the whole atmosphere or create a deep and everlasting winter. This seems to me the worst possibility of all. It would mean the division of the world between two or three vast superstates, unable to conquer one another and unable to be overthrown by an internal rebellion. In all probability, their structure would be hierarchic, with a semi-divine caste at the top and outright slavery at the bottom. And the crushing out of liberty would exceed anything the world has yet seen. Within each world, the necessary psychological atmosphere would be kept up by complete severance from the outside world and by a continuous phony war against rival states. Civilizations of this kind might remain static for thousands of years. So in calling 1984 a satire, I'm not saying that some of the essential elements of the plot were not meant by him very literally. Indeed, the first and obvious subject of satire in the novel, so obvious that many literary critics seem to ignore it as being so obvious as not to be worth mentioning, is this slight matter of the division of the world between the great powers. And this division of the world, in Orwell's mind, had already taken place at Yalta and Potsdam, with the pigs and the men carving up the farmyard between them at the end of Animal Farm. He'd already had a go at that one. And to my mind, the calling of Britain as Airstrip 1, calling Great Britain Airstrip 1 in Orwell's imaginary Oceania in 1984, that was a very old joke indeed. It's been Airstrip 1, we've had the honour to be Airstrip 1 in my country since 1941, when the airstrips were being prepared for the Boeing bombers to bomb Germany that hadn't even been produced as yet in the Lockheed factories. Very nice piece of wartime planning. That's a very old joke, so please don't laugh too loud in case the house falls down. That one was a fairly easy prophecy. That's not about the future, it's about, well, a continuous present. And when Winston Smith reads Goldstein's Testament, the revolutionary book of the Brotherhood, allegedly, he learns that after a short atomic war in 1956, the great powers have realized that they will wipe each other out if they use them, so therefore they only stockpile them. Why do they stockpile useless bombs? Goldstein explains that the burning off of surplus value by military expenditure is so that the existing elites can be preserved by preventing the abolition of poverty that would give equality and therefore political power to the masses. It's a rather crude, some of you may think, socialist satire. Now, we British on Airstrip 1 certainly do not live in a military dictatorship of the kind that even the non-fictional Orwell feared, and nor do North American inhabitants of Oceania either. But we do surely live in a society with a crazily unnecessary possession of atomic weapons, a vast military expenditure, and now a huge apparatus of security surveillance. Swift, Orwell's hero and model, did not, in his Gulliver's Travels, believe that there were giants in Brobdingnag, and nor did most of his readers, but he did believe that mankind could be brutal and reckless towards each other, not merely conscious brutality, but the brutality that sometimes happens in everyday life as well as in politics when one treads on somebody because one doesn't notice that they're there. And Swift did not believe that there were dwarves in a place called Lilliput either, but he did believe, wicked man, wicked satirist, that men could be pompous, parochial, and petty-minded. Similarly with Orwell, his second great satiric thrust in the book is simply the abuse of power in general. Oh yes, totalitarian power, Soviet power, but also a fear that something like Nazi power might recur. He's writing in 1948, he's not writing in 1984, and also, I think, protesting against quite ordinary abuses of power in everyday life, when people tread on other people or, as I said, don't even notice that they're there. When the interrogator torturer O'Brien in the interrogation scene gives Winston Smith, like in any good quiz program, a free question, and Winston asks what they are doing it all for, he bleakly replies that they are doing it for nothing. simply for the sake of power. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. Now, I don't believe for one moment that Orwell thought that all men were like that, but he is suggesting that many men are like that and that power can corrupt. Indeed, Orwell, in his non-fictional essays, specifically denied that totalitarian regimes didn't believe in their ideologies. He said in an essay on Hitler, "Don't fool yourself that Hitler is just a power-hungry clown. Better to see Hitler as Antichrist. He really does believe in the ideology." And yet in 1984, Orwell pictures the inner party as believing in nothing. So to that extent, he isn't directly satirizing either Nazism or communism at that point. He is satirizing any possible abuse of power, those who do become power hungry, not merely in national political situations, but as I say, in everyday life. He had a liberal feeling, close to Lord Acton's famous dictum, that all power corrupts, against which we have to guard ourselves rationally, and that indeed absolute power corrupts absolutely. He's not merely getting at Stalin and Hitler, or possible future Stalins and Hitlers, he's getting at the pompous dog, he's getting at the pompous boss and the petty dog in office. The nominal target of the storyline is a future totalitarianism one, is a future totalitarianism. The actual one is ever-present bureaucracy and any jack in office or public servant who grows too big for his boots and forgets whom he serves. He was one of the first to speculate that the real enemy of the future might not be a bad ideology, but a mundane bureaucracy. Another related object of Orwell's satire, to whom he had an almost perverse suspicion, were the intellectuals. He felt that by and large the intellectuals had betrayed the common people, had ceased to stand for the old radical image of organize and agitate, had settled down into quiet, comfortable jobs in schools, universities, the BBC, or publishing. Winston and his companions in the Ministry of Truth in the novel, the poet Ampleforth, the dictionary maker Syme, Winston himself perpetually rewriting the Times, God, what a job, and falsifying history, are all parodies of intellectuals who should know better, who do know better, but who decide to stick to their jobs rather than protest. And we all know, after all, in the universities and elsewhere, that if we do resign on a point of principle, some even bigger bastard will be appointed in our place. So we soldier on. I think, actually, Orwell's wartime service in the BBC had a very, very bad effect on him indeed. He'd never seen so many intellectuals all gathered together in one place, all broadcasting in strange languages to different parts of the world, and I fear he had certain doubts about whether these men would stand up for their principles. A little bit self-righteous of him, perhaps. There has been so much in the popular press this year about 1984, but not a whisper that one of the great satiric targets in the novel is the popular press itself. Winston refers several times to rubbishy newspapers being produced in the Ministry of Truth to divert and debase the proles, in that marvelous word, to provide prole feed. Films, football, beer, and above all gambling filled up the horizons of their mind. To keep them in control was not difficult. And he describes the newspapers as being filled with this, with sex, with violence, with crime, with anything except serious politics. That's what Dear Julia is mainly working on, and her colleagues. Like many 19th century radicals had, Orwell had hoped that a century of the mass franchise and 50 years of compulsory secondary education would have created an active participant mass of citizens. In fact, he saw, in his gloomy vision, millions of people reading rubbishy newspapers soon to turn into telescreens. Winston Smith and Orwell believed that if there was hope, it lay in the proles. He perhaps romanticized, certainly idolized, the virtues and morality of the common man. He really did believe that the middle classes are more racked by competitive individualism, are more racked by desire for material goods, and are pushed in a position of a competitive individualism. And he really did believe that the working men or the common people had more fraternity and solidarity. But nonetheless, he felt a bitter, Swiftian rage at the actual content of the mass press of his day. Remember what dear Julia's job consisted in? Writing pornographic novels for the proles by machinery. Again, listen to what Orwell has to say in a contemporary essay of 1946 called The Prevention of Literature. And he's so humorless that he even has a go at the great democratic god of childhood of that time, the saintly Walt Disney. "It would probably be not beyond human ingenuity to write books by machinery. But a sort of mechanizing process can already be seen at work in the film and radio, in publicity and propaganda, and in the lower reaches of journalism. Disney films, for instance, are produced by what is essentially a factory process, the work being done partly mechanically and partly by means of artists who have to subordinate their individual style. Radio features are commonly written by tired hacks to whom the subject and manner of treatment are dictated beforehand. Even so, what they write is merely a kind of raw material to be chopped into shape by producers and censors." And he ends with a magnificently gratuitous generalization. "So also with the innumerable books and pamphlets commissioned by government departments." Now that business about the kind of raw material to be chopped into shape by producers and censors is actually a metaphor without any very clear technical subject matter. He was writing before the common use of radio tape. No wonder the courts are so very, very cautious, in my country at least, about using evidence based on tape recorders when it's so easy to stitch together and make anything you want of it. There is rumoured to be, in the depths of the Ministry of Truth, I mean in the BBC, an obscene Christmas address by Her Majesty the Queen. done as a kind of technical exercise in a BBC training school, but I think also, you know, as a kind of warning shot to demonstrate outside the building, don't trust tapes. All this, that kind of passage I've read, is the generation, the origin of the idea of prole feed in 1984. The main instrument of controlling the masses has become, according to Orwell, not coercion and surveillance, but cultural debasement. As a fellow called Gramsci in an Italian prison, or had been in an Italian prison, had been arguing, quite unknown to Orwell. That's what the highbrow Marxists mean by cultural hegemony. It is too little noticed that the author tells us specifically in 1984 that the thought police go very rarely into the streets and homes of the proles, that there are very few telescreens in the homes of the proles. It's badly wrong there. It is the bureaucracy in the novel, or the outer party, who are subject to the maximum of terror and surveillance. The proles are kept controlled, most economically, by cultural debasement and by the provision by the state of pornography, gambling, booze and drugs. Our kind of state, Orwell knew quite well, does not provide those kind of things, it only tolerates them. It does not itself actually provide them. He did exaggerate. It was a literary satire, like Swift's Gulliver. It is full of deliberately grotesque exaggerations. These things are there just as strongly as the more obvious, as the more often noticed satires on the debasement of language and on the perversion of historical truth. But Orwell, in fact, is not despairing. He does not believe that newspeak will ever work, that it is possible to control language utterly, nor that history could ever be completely rewritten. I think he simply fears the cruelty and suffering that follow from political attempts to do so. A press release issued after the appearance of the book, which I reprint both in my biography and in my recent Clarendon Press edition of 1984. A press release says that it was his view that this or something like... Sorry, the press release denies that it was his view that this or something like this is what will happen within the next 40 years in the Western world. He said that, allowing for the book being, after all, a parody, something like 1984 could happen. Not will happen, but could happen. This is the direction in which the world is going in at the present time, and the trend lies deep in the political and social and economic foundations of the contemporary world situation. Indeed, he went further. Specifically, the danger lies in the structure imposed on capitalist, socialist, and liberal communities alike. Now, he plainly, by capitalist, socialist, and liberal, I'm afraid he means North America, Europe, which he rather optimistically thought was going democratic socialist after the war, and liberal communities, by the necessity to prepare for war with the USSR and the new weapons, of which, of course, the atom bomb is the most powerful and the most publicized. He did not despair, but was he wrong to find it hard to provide false optimism rather than warnings of the bleak and cruel world into which we may descend, even now, if we lose our respect for truth, liberty, and human equality? Above all else, in 1984, Orwell is satirizing the pretensions of a rigidly hierarchical society, the sole raison d'etre of the political regime in Oceania is to prevent equality. Now, I certainly concede, as would Orwell, above all, that an egalitarian regime without liberty can be, indeed would be, totalitarian and enforced equality. But the much greater likelihood, he thought, in the modern world is that hierarchical regimes based upon the seeming need to accumulate huge defense expenditures create not a literal 1984, but something bad enough to make us feel, when reading the novel again, that too little has improved, that some things have even got worse, and that there is much to be done if they are not to get far, far worse. Orwell's democratic socialism, like R.H. Tawney's, was of that kind that distrusted the centralized state, whether nominally socialist or nominally capitalist. He liked small nations, provinces, localities. Above all, he disliked empires and superpowers. In an attack on a once fashionable intellectual, James Burnham, the author of The Managerial Revolution, Orwell wrote, centralized ownership has very little meaning unless the mass of people are living roughly upon an equal level and have some kind of control over government. The state may come to mean no more than a self-elected political party, and oligarchy and privilege can return based on power rather than on money. Socialists and radicals, Orwell would have us believe, must be as opposed to bureaucracy as they profess to be to class privilege. But no literary satire can be read like an economic or social model or projection. But the targets of his satire, if of varying and different significance, still seem to me things that should worry us, just as his respect for truth, liberty, and plain language should cheer us. We normally tackle the great problem of how to limit arbitrary power in two ways. One is to set power against power, or institutional restraints, the Constitution and all that. Two, we believe in reason, persuasion, debate, dialogue, some might add prayer. Orwell adds a third dimension, though, that is very often ignored, indeed is most often ignored by all the serious academic commentators about how to limit arbitrary power, but is in fact the common or garden technique that most people who live under ordinary, under arbitrary power practice all day long and habitually, indeed even in free countries when we feel we have governments in for a very long run who are unlikely to be changed, there's usually a great outbreak of satire. We use sardonic mockery to try to cut the pretensions of the great down to human size. I put it to you, to mention 1984 almost for the last time, that Orwell, both in Animal Farm and 1984, is offering a deliberate, controlled exercise in political satire. We should not read the whole thing too gloomily. Let me read the gloomiest passage of all, and